All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the first day of October 2019. I do like to remind you that I'm the author of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. It's a company that focuses, it's a newsletter that focuses primarily on junior exploration companies, and gold has gotten hit fairly hard the last couple of days, last week or so, and a lot of the shares have gone down as well. I think it's an excellent time, if you believe as I do that we're in a long-term bull market for gold, an excellent time to take a look at some of these exciting stories that I talk about every week in my letter. I'd like to also encourage you to go to chenpicks.com to sign up for my friend Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Especially if you're interested in biotechs and some things other than gold and silver and the exploration stocks. Chen covers them too to an extent, but he has really done very, very well with the biotechs, has made a lot of money for his subscribers and in his own account. Also, like to always have you think about Michael Oliver, olivermsa.com. We'll be talking to Michael in just a moment. I want to thank all of you for listening to the show, making it the one of the top shows in the Voice America Business Channel. Always encourage you to send along any comments you might have about this show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions, the number for taylor@gmail.com. And last but not least, we want to thank our sponsors for making the show economically viable. Our sponsors for this week's show are Novo Resources and Great Bear Resources, two of my favorite companies, I might add. Well, I've titled today's show, China or the USA, Alistair MacLeod, Dr. Quentin Henning, and Michael Oliver return. The title of today's show and much of what I hope to cover is derived from an essay Alistair wrote on September 5th. In providing an overview of the article, he wrote the following in the opening paragraph, and I quote, China has made some silly errors in its conflict with the U.S., reflecting the arrogance that often afflicts every state actor. But the appearance that China is being backed into a corner over Huawei, trade tariffs, and Hong Kong is misleading. China is progressing her own plans, and they do not require an accommodation with America. With Russia in tow, she is now the chief foreign influence for up to three-quarters of the world's population. So it is American hegemony that's being backed into a corner. One day, this will be reflected in a currency shootout. End of quote. So when we talk to Alistair in the second half of today's show, I want to find out what he thinks the dollar might look like after that shootout takes place, what might trigger a shootout, and given the outlook that Alistair sees for the dollar, then I want to ask him what advice he might have for us, of course. What should we do in planning, not only financially, but perhaps in other ways, if we get to that. Dr. Quentin Henning will join me after our first commercial break. Well, you talk about another favorite gold exploration stock that that I own and that I cover in my newsletter. And I'm not talking about Novo Resources, not today anyway, although that remains a top pick of mine. I expect to have Dr. Henning with me for an update on Novo in the near future, I think in a couple of weeks from now perhaps. Quentin is the leading geologist, however, for Irving Resources, and he sits on the board of directors of that company exploring for gold in Japan. It is a company... This is a company it's my second largest holding. So, of course, I'm very interested in what Dr. Henning will have to say about Irving Resources. Right now, I'm happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with me once again to provide his latest thoughts on some of the markets that are most important to us. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you, and I missed you last week. We were my wife and I were in Portugal taking care of some business, a little bit of a vacation. But I always I need my Michael Oliver fix every Tuesday, so I'm really glad you're with me. On September 29th, you put out a commentary on gold and silver, and actually you did an update again today, which I haven't had the chance to look at today. But talk to us a little bit about what you see for gold. I know a lot of nervous Nellies out there that watch the price charts and not your momentum work that get a little bit scared when they see gold going down. And then if they own the shares, sometimes those shares go down percentage-wise even a lot more than gold. But what are your latest thoughts on gold now?
Well, the back in early September, we put out a report that finally said, okay, if you want to take some profits, go ahead and take some if you're nervous. But we suggested make sure it's partial because this bull trend's not over. But at least then, with gold having reached 1550, we saw enough reasons to say, okay, they could have a congestion zone or a pullback. Okay. We thought the pullback might find support, and again, we're in the 1500s when we put this out, for around 1485. Well, it happened to drop just above 1485 a week or two later, stopped, rallied. Next week came down to 1484, stopped, rallied. And last week went down to 1485 area again. Well, that's probably too many times coming down to what we thought might be support. And the floor broke. The floor broke, and it broke yesterday hard. You finally broke below 1485 and followed a little bit more today down into the 1450s and then whipped back up. And the reason, of course, for the rally is the manufacturing news, which suggests that now the Fed has another metric by which to, you know, justify further rate cuts, et cetera, et cetera. And that was our main argument recently in that first report you mentioned, is instead of looking at gold's technicals right now, which everybody does, look outside of it, at least three other major markets, Dollar Index, Bloomberg Commodity Index, and the S&P 500. Those markets have not justified the gold advance we've seen, which is a 34% advance over 13 months, the summer of last year up to the high we made this last month. There was no, if you looked at the Bloomberg Commodity Index, it was going down, no commodity inflation. Looked at the S&P, it was holding its own. Yes, it had a sharp sell-off in December, but basically got back up to the highs and went comfy. And then when you look at the dollar, it was firm. It had risen 2%. From August of last year to August of this year, September this year. 2%, but that is firm, but not a dynamic trend. But none of those markets offered a reason for gold to have done what it did.
Right.
Okay, we argued at that point, September 1st, aside from the possibility of a little correction, that we needed now to see one of these three or all of these three major markets have a trend change. We've defined the numbers, what we determined to be an S&P downturn, and we're triggering one of them today, but it's not the most important one. And we also determined on the dollar index, we've adjusted our numbers. It's a new quarter. We've adjusted them up, and they're not far below the market. And on the Bloomberg Commodity Index, we've got some numbers just above it that would indicate commodities are joining in. So we think it's probably best now for gold watchers to look beyond the gold pit and look beyond the gold miners and look at these three other markets because they're likely to give wind at the back of gold when they turn. Stocks turn down, dollar turns down, Bloomberg commodities turn up. So you got to watch those three markets. I think they're major sources of potential support for gold and a justification for the next up wave in gold.
All right. What about how's silver looking relative to gold? I mean, it was looking real strong.
It's just like the gold miners. You know, it goes up more than gold, and it goes down more than gold on a percent basis. So it's like, you know, a poodle on the leash. It runs in front of you and then runs behind you, okay? We argue based on some long-term spread relationship between silver and gold and the momentum of the spread specifically that silver has, in fact, broken its leash, its decline in performance over the last 3 years, that the recent surge of the last several months pushed it out enough ahead of gold where it's now saying, I want to tend to outpace gold.
Okay. All right. So with respect to the treasuries, I mean, today is a would seem to be a risk-off day. Gold's up a bit, I guess. The Dow, I'm looking at the Dow down about 280 points. Looks like a risk-off day. Are the treasuries up a bit today as a result?
Are they benefiting? About a three-point rally off the low of the day. again, yeah. probably for the same justification that gold had a rally, and that is, okay, we got a big data point today that nobody expected, and it's scary, and it's the kind of thing that these academician types at the Fed can say, well, you know, we're number sensitive. Okay, well, you got a number there. And it's the kind of thing that could induce them to, you know, more cuts and possibly not even wait for a meeting.
Sure.
The question is, will the stock market have a tantrum now to force the Fed to respond to that
yeah.
news? You know, of course, if the stock market goes down, the Fed will respond,
mm-hmm.
no matter what they say.
Michael, with just about a couple of minutes left here yet, the dollar, we're going to be talking to Alistair McLeod in the last half of today's show, and a big part of that will have to do with the future of the dollar in view of the growing competition that the buck has with the Chinese yuan, and the Chinese in
mm-hmm.
general are an ascending power. I think most people would agree to that. But near term, as Alistair has pointed out in his essay, when we start to have credit problems, when we start to have, that is, when we run into, when the credit cycle is over and we start to run into some real severe financial problems, the dollar usually gains because it is the largest, it is the world's reserve currency, the largest debts out there, a lot of short covering of the dollar, if you will. People have to go out and buy dollars to pay back the margin clerk, so to speak. But what are you seeing in terms of your dollar work right now?
Well, the dollar, again, had a strong rally from early 2018 to August of 2018. In fact, that was the bulk of the rally from a low at $88 index, I'm talking about, to 97, so it had a 9-point rally. And then it leveled off and continued to drift higher for the last 13 months. Right now it's about 99, so it's
yeah.
about 2% above where it was in August of last year. So
uh-huh.
it's going up at a snail's pace. It's steady. But our argument is if you get down in the much below the mid-97 area,
mm-hmm.
a point and a half down,
mm-hmm.
you're going to trigger downside.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this crawl that we've seen in the dollar, a firm tone but a crawl, will break down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we're watching because it has significance to other things. For example,
oh.
if you own U.S. stocks and you're a foreign investor, you own them in dollars.
Yep.
Well, so far the dollar's not intimidated you in terms of your investment in U.S. stocks.
Right.
If the S&P starts to rattle you and the dollar does as well, it makes
mm-hmm.
the situation, it makes it even worse than simply
yeah.
the stock market turning down.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of dominoes here.
Yeah. Well, that would certainly make for a very rapid exit by foreigners, I would think, if both
mm-hmm.
of those things
mm-hmm.
hit them in the kisser, right? So
it would
right,
rattle well, them more than it would a U.S. investor who doesn't
yeah,
care.
Yeah, indeed,
like,
indeed,
them,
indeed.
Would,
but the U.S. investor...
Yeah.
But the U.S. investor starts seeing his S&Ps tank and his 401k go down real hard. Wow. We've seen that happen before. I
mm-hmm.
hope it doesn't, but history suggests it will. And all the trouble we're getting ourselves into with all of the debt growing much faster than income, says something's got to give, you'd think so. Anyway, thank you so much for being with us, Michael. And
thanks, Jay.
We'll look to do it again next week. Well, folks, we do have to go to break. Don't go away, though. Dr. Quentin Hanning will be with me to talk about, no, not Noble Resources this time, but Irving Resources, another favorite of mine, company exploring for gold in Japan. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Hanning.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Dr. Quentin Henning. Dr. Henning has been with us a number of times. Normally, we speak to him about Novo Resources, which company is exploring and developing a most unusual style of gold mineralization in Western Australia. We will talk to Dr. Henning. We're expecting to, at least in the not-too-distant future, for an update on Novo. But today, I have him here on this show to discuss another company that I... one of my favorites, my second largest personal holding, I might say, one of my favorites in my newsletter. It's another company that he's intimately involved with in providing a vision of potential wealth creation through gold exploration in Japan. The company that I want to introduce is named Irving Resources and trades on the Canadian exchange. IRV is a symbol, trades in the U.S. where I purchased it, IRVRF, 48.8 million shares outstanding. $1.84 earlier today when I looked at it anyway, giving it a market cap of right around $90 million U.S. dollars. Now, Irving Resources is involved, as I say, in gold exploration in Japan. Akiko Levinson, who is of Japanese descent and an experienced mining executive, is the president and CEO of the company. Now, I've known Akiko for more than a decade. She is not only a very classy lady, but a mining executive with decades of experience in the industry. But she conducts her business with the highest of ethical standards. And her connections to the Japanese society and to culture is of utmost importance in opening doors for Irving Resources in a country that is not as open as many others when it comes to foreign investors. Akiko has worked very closely with Dr. Henning over a number of years as a director of Irving and the leading geologist for the company's exploration efforts. Dr. Henning is here to talk about Irving's current exploration work and what shareholders should look forward to. Well, thanks for joining me again, Dr. Henning.
Absolutely, Jay. Always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to hear your voice. Normally, we want to ask you about Novo, and I'm really, of course, very anxious about that. I know a lot of our listeners are, too. But today, we want to ask you about Irving Resources, and we don't generally talk about companies or think about Japan as a country where we're going to invest in gold, but it has had a history of gold production. Can you briefly talk about that and perhaps a little bit and introduce to us Irving's flagship property? I think it's called the Omu Project. Compare geologically that with and potentially from a production perspective, does Omu have some potential along the lines of some of the other producers in Japan that have been producing gold for a number of years?
Oh, very good question. So I'll kind of give a Japan Gold 101 lecture.
Okay.
So, gold was discovered in Japan, and there's at least some documented mining of gold clear back around the 8th century, as I understand it. But more importantly, gold took kind of front and center when the Edo period started in the early 1600s. So for about the last 400 years, gold production has been an important part of the Japanese economy. Most people don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of multi-million ounce gold deposits around Japan. Almost all of these deposits are what we call epithermal vein deposits. They were formed in hot spring environments. During formation, you can produce very high grades in places, especially associated with what we call the boiling horizon within the system. Examples would be the Sado deposit. Sado Island is immediately west of Honshu, produced on the order of 2.5 million ounces. There's the Konami deposit up in Hokkaido near our Omu project.
It produced
around 2.5 million ounces. There's several examples down in Kyushu, which is the southernmost island in Japan. There's the world famous Hishikari deposit. Right, so Hishikari, it was late to come in terms of exploration. It was found in the early 1980s, but it has been the flagship gold producer in Japan. And most people don't realize this, but it's the highest grade operating mine in the world. Has been from several two or three decades now, right? So it's produced around I believe, around 8 million ounces at present. The average head grade started out around 80 grams per ton. Now it's hovering around 30 or 40 grams per ton. It is an amazing deposit. It consists of numerous epithermal veins. Like I said, these are veins of quartz. They're usually banded. They have little thin layers called ginguro, which is, comprises silver-rich minerals as well as particles of gold. And interestingly, almost all of the production in Japan, almost all of these veins have been used as smelter flux. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, they mine the material, the silica-rich vein material. They put it into smelters when they're smelting base metals like copper, mm-hmm. lead, or zinc, or these kind of metals. And the gold and the silver actually come out as a byproduct. But it means very cheap, very simple processing that's, it's highly effective. It's the Japanese are the most resourceful people I'm finding on the planet. They just do things much differently, but much more effectively than elsewhere in the world.
All right. So, and your Omu project, does it have some geological characteristics with those kind of epithermal vein types that you're talking about, the quartz banded?
Yes. Sorry, I forgot that part of the question. But yes, Omu is an epithermal vein system. The property is around 200 square kilometers at present. We have at least three main focus areas. These are very large targets on the property. One is called Omu Center, one is called the Omui Mine, and then one is called Hokuria Mine. These have at least some historic production, albeit on a minor scale. Most were shut down because of the war. During the Second World War, they shut down gold production at a certain point to conserve resources and, more importantly, people. But these veins have a lot of potential. We've got places where we see veins literally sticking out of the ground at a very high grade, very characteristic of other nearby mines, such as Konami, where 2.5 million ounces was discovered.
Mm-hmm. What are your? Could you discuss your exploration program that's currently underway, and what might we expect to get from that? What are the objectives of this program, first of all, and what might investors be looking out for?
Yes, that's a very detailed question. So yeah. let me kind of pick it apart. Like I said, we have three main target areas on the Omu property. Uh-huh. Center, Omui Mine, and then Hokuria Mine, and these are all in their own right a large project. Okay, so we basically have three large projects in one property.
Wow.
We've been drilling at Omu Center. We drilled 8 holes earlier this year. Those holes are in the assay lab. We expect those assays to come back here shortly. The labs are very, very tight for capacity at this point. We've been shipping the samples down to Australia. Unfortunately, in Australia right now, it's the height of the season down there. So, our samples, along with millions of others, are in a very long queue at the laboratories. But we'll have assays for those. We did see initial high-grade results out of some of the early holes of that program. But I expect we'll see some more high-grade results in samples that are going to come back here shortly. In the meantime, we are now starting drilling at Omui Mine. So this is a new drill campaign, develop targets, and we're going to implement around 3,000 meters at Omui by the end of this year. We're also doing things like bulk sampling. At Omui Mine, we're actually collecting material as we excavate some trenches. We're collecting vein material and stockpiling that. And we plan to ship that to the Kushikino smelter in Japan sometime later this year, or perhaps early next year.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand your vision here, is that you are expecting not to construct your own milling facility here, assuming this goes forward into a producing mine, one or two or three mines potentially, but that you are really looking to, is it the same sort of a flux?
Yes, this is the model, the business model. Mm-hmm. We anticipate, think of it like finding gold and silver-rich silica flux for a smelter. Okay, that's our goal. We are trying to identify vein types with low deleterious elements but high gold and silver concentrations that are ideally suited to ship to a smelter. We don't want to build a mill on site. We don't see a need to. The smelters are quite hungry across Japan. There's probably on the order of 20 of them, 20 base metal smelters that demand, on the order of tens of thousands of tons of flux each per year.
Ah, Oh, good. So that means potentially lower CapEx, I guess, than if you had to go about, you know, get permitting and getting a mill built and all that.
That's the idea, yes.
Yeah. All right. So can you work through the, I don't know what the weather conditions, I guess you have a severe winter there. Quinton,
yes.
Is fairly north. So do you work through, will you be working December, January, February, that time frame or not this year?
We will. So we brought over a Canadian crew. This is a drill company based in Winnipeg. They drilled for us at Spring Pole near Red Lake. So mm-hmm. Their experience with winter drilling, Hokkaido is a very cold climate, gets lots of snow in the winter. It's not nearly as cold as Red Lake, but it is cold. And these guys are used to drilling, in these conditions. So, yes, we plan on drilling over the winter months. We'll move from Omi Mine down to Omu Center and resume drilling there in the early part of next year.
Your company, really, the number of shares, as I mentioned, only about 50 million shares. 25% of those are owned by management, pretty tightly held. What can you? Are there any strategic investors in the picture? And I notice also that you just recently had some discussions with Sumitomo, who you have had a good relationship with, you and Akiko. And of course, Sumitomo is with you, doing some work with you with Novo over in Australia. But could you comment a little bit on who owns your company and its share structure? Because that's always important, obviously.
Absolutely.
And how well funded are you to go forward?
Certainly. So the share structure is quite tight, as you know. It's less than 50 million shares out. Akiko and I both own a substantial amount. Eric Sprott's a big investor, but Newmont joined us as an investor about 3 or 4 months ago.
Wow.
Took part in a placement. They have a right to put more money in, at various stages, depending on what they see. But we've also brought Sumitomo to the table. Sumitomo has become a good supporter of Novo, as you said, but they're also mm-hmm. quite interested in what we're doing in Japan. They've also got a very long working relationship with Newmont. So, this is effectively a great partnership because if Newmont, for example, wants to enter Japan in a big way, Sumitomo would be a great Japanese mining company host to work with. So it's really come together like a perfect storm here. It's just a wonderful situation. We don't see the need for going back to the market anytime soon. We have on the order of $10 or $11 million in the bank. We have some warrants and options expiring here shortly, which will help top up the treasury. But we have a lot of runway to work with and very good shareholder support.
You obviously, you're very busy with Novo Resources, and I know that a lot of companies, exploration companies around the world are interested in getting your services whenever they can get their hands on a bit of your time. But you're not alone there. You have some other good people working with you there in Japan. Would you care to comment just briefly on who some of the other talented people are there that working for Irving Resources in Japan?
Yes. We've recently hired a gentleman named Takeshi Uemoto as our exploration manager. Takeshi has been working for Gold Fields in Australia. He is a fantastic combination for us. Because he, obviously he's Japanese national, but he knows Western style exploration, so that's a great benefit to us. Mendeko, which is part of Mitsui, does all our contract work, and Harada mm-hmm. Is our lead there. He's oversees the project for Mendeko. He's been working with us for several years. We have basically a first-class Japanese team to tackle this, and I'm very grateful for all their help because, working in Japan as a Westerner, especially with the language barrier, can mm-hmm. be challenging.
I would think so, to say the least. All right. Well, just then, in summing up here, what should we be, those of us who own this stock, and I think a lot of other people ought to start taking a look at it, frankly, but I don't care if they don't, because I think you're going to really provide some real value here, I believe. I'm very optimistic. But what should we be looking forward to, Quinton? You'll have some bulk sample assays, some assay drill assays coming out soon. And will there be a continual flow? You mentioned you can work through the winter up there. So might we expect a constant flow once the labs get caught up?
Yes, all of the above, basically, yes. The labs are the biggest, the stickiest wicket at this time, but we will have constant drill program and drill results coming over the next year or two. High-grade veins are our target. We should have samples from surface as well as drilling. We should be able to demonstrate that this is a very high quality asset in a jurisdiction that, that will make a fantastic mine.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us about Irving. And, of course, we'll look to talk to you about Novo, I think, in the next several weeks or so you're scheduled. So I hope we can get you back with us. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us, Quentin, and your knowledge and expertise.
Anytime.
All righty. Well, we do have to go to break now, folks. Don't go away, though. Alistair MacLeod is with us to discuss the rising competition for global dominance between the United States and China. So don't go away. This should be really interesting in terms of the future of the dollar and hence has some ramifications for some of the other markets that we follow so closely. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Alistair MacLeod.
Rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on their wholly owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Canada. Having recently made four major gold discoveries, GBR is now fully funded to drill 90,000 meters through to the year 2020 as part of a very active exploration program. Rob McEwen of McEwen Mining, a Red Lake veteran, is a significant shareholder following a recent $5.7 million investment. To stay up to date, visit greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair MacLeod. Today, I would like to chat with Alistair about an article he recently wrote, I think earlier in September, actually, one of the first days of September. He wrote an article called China or U.S., you can all go and read it, which I would suggest you do that and Alistair's other essays that are there. He writes a weekly piece that's put up there every at goldmoney.com. So goldmoney.com and for Alistair MacLeod's insights, which are very valuable, which is one of the reasons he's one of the most frequent guests on this show. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very
It's really good to have you, Alistair. Are you hearing me okay?
I can hear you fine, yes.
Okay, good. You are very critical of tariffs, and as are most economists, I think, of virtually every stripe. And you make the statement that, and I quote, tariffs arise out of political ignorance of the economics of trade imbalances, end of quote. And I agree with you, but it is also true that since about the time that Richard Nixon detached gold from the dollar, America has run chronic and deepening trade deficits that that have served to enrich the, I would argue at least, that's my view, to enrich the elite political, academic, financial classes in America at the expense of the middle class working people. But in any event, they're indisputable that we've had a chronic trade deficit. So if tariffs aren't the answer, what is the answer to this chronic trade problem that we have?
Well, you're absolutely right about unfettered monetary inflation. And the answer is quite simple. Stop monetary inflation. Yeah. Because what happens is if you push extra money into the economy, which is not actually if you like, spent on production. And I'm talking about the existing stock. So you're talking about extra money coming into the economy, either in the form of base money or in credit. Then unless the savers actually turn around and save that money, you're going to get a trade deficit. It's actually as simple as that. And so the trade deficit is simply the consequence of monetary inflation, inflation which basically allows the government to spend more than it raises in taxes. And so the answer is quite simple. Just stop doing it, and then you won't have a trade deficit problem.
It, in the process, as I mentioned, it also seems to have created a reallocation of income from different classes. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do entirely. I mean, the whole point about monetary inflation is that it transfers wealth from ordinary people to the government and the banks. And it does it in such a way that very, very few of them actually understand what's happening. And that's the beauty of it, because from the government's point of view, because if you, you know, if you raise taxes, everybody knows that you raise taxes. This way you print some money. It's complete. You can't tell the difference between existing money and new money that's come in. It's not as if they've got serial numbers or anything. And so therefore, you know, you can do it and get away with it. Of course, at some stage, you find that prices start rising because you're creating an imbalance in the economy with all this extra money. It lowers the purchasing power of the of not only the existing money but the new money as well, as it sort of filters through the system, robbing people of the value of their wages and their savings. And that is actually what it's all about.
Yeah, redistribution to those that control the monetary system, essentially, and that's the government and the banks, as you say, would argue that there are government-sponsored businesses such as the military-industrial complex. That, they those fellows like it quite a bit, too. But anyway, I don't want to get off the track here because you mentioned in your article that China has made some silly errors regarding its relationship with the U.S. One was that they should not have retaliated against Trump's tariffs. Why would China have been better off not to have retaliated against Trump? It seems like a tit for tat is sort of human nature, isn't it?
Well, it's human nature, and it's politically, you know, it's almost impossible to resist the temptation. But the fact is that if you impose tariffs on imported goods, what you're doing is you're taxing your people. And it's as simple as that. In fact, you see this with President Trump claiming, you know, I'm Mr. Tariff Man, you know, we're raising revenue through tariffs. Actually, what you're doing is, you know, he's not taxing the Chinese, he's taxing the American people. And the same goes for China the other way. By far the best thing they could have done is just actually ignore the tariff. You know, difficult emotionally and all the rest of it, but purely from the point of view of ensuring that the Chinese economy produces the best outcome for its people, they should ignore the tariffs. You cannot do anything about someone else's tariffs imposed on your goods. You know, just forget it. I mean, you know, that's their affair, unfortunately. But so this was a big mistake by China. If they actually understood what it was about, to the you know, to the and the importance, if you like, of being able to buy from the cheapest source, the best source, whatever, you know, whatever goods you need, that is of so much benefit to the Chinese economy. So they've in effect they've taken a huge step backwards by following President Trump with these tariffs.
Well, if that was a big mistake, I gather in reading your essay that a bigger one was made by China in allowing tensions in Hong Kong to accelerate. Can you explain why that was so bad for China?
Yes. The point about Hong Kong is that Hong Kong is the funnel through which all outside investment into China from the West goes. Now, this is very important because China has a massive program of infrastructure spending and general economic improvement, and that does need foreign portfolio flows. And it was by setting up something called Shanghai Connect, which basically goes through Hong Kong. And what it means is that an international portfolio manager can invest in China without having to go through exchange controls, and he can take his money out of China through exactly the same mechanism with no let or hindrance whatsoever. So it's a completely sort of free investment channel, as it were. So so that is very important. Now, as far as America is concerned, she sees she has an enormous dependency, if you like, on foreign investment in U.S. treasuries in particular.
Sure.
For the government to continue to spend beyond its means without tapping, if you like, the non-existing savings of its people. So it needs those foreign flows. It needs them more than China needs them, as far as America is concerned. So what does she do? She tries to destabilize Hong Kong. This, at least anyway, is the way the Chinese are looking at it. I mean, I have no evidence, direct evidence, that this is the case. But this is the way the Chinese look at it. So, and we saw long before the current round of riots started that in America they started clearing the decks on the legislative front in case the Chinese went ahead with this extradition law, which was the earliest stage of being mooted. And having done that, the Chinese still went ahead with it, which I think was a huge mistake. I mean, for goodness sake, the Chinese can get anyone they want out of Hong Kong by doing it on the quiet. I mean, why produce a law which gives America the excuse to march in, you know, stir up the agitation and put off every international investor from investing through Shanghai Connect?
Right.
And if you want a further confirmation of this, of course, there was this story last week that the American administration might force Chinese companies to delist from American stock exchanges. And there were various other stories about control of Chinese capital flows in America and all the rest of it. You know, it's quite obvious that the American administration basically want the money either that China has or China is making, or China hopes to attract. That is why the Hong Kong thing was the most stupid mistake.
All right, so they made some stupid mistakes, but I gather your view is that China is an ascending power. It's going to rise no matter what happens. You comment on the bigger picture and say that China and Russia are positioned to take control of the global energy markets. Can you explain why that is happening and what it might mean for the future of the dollar, which has depended, of course, known as the petrodollar, of course. And so could you comment on that and perhaps what that might mean for the petrodollar?
Yes, of course. What I mean by that, well, Russia is already the largest exporter of energy in the world. Now, Russia's energy includes natural gas as well as oil. She is second in oil to Saudi Arabia. Basically, what has happened is that the Middle Eastern political situation has evolved in such a way that Iran has been forced into the hands of Russia by dollar sanctions against her using the dollar, and also into the hands of China. So you've got, if you like, three parties in Asia now effectively in control of the majority of the world's energy supplies. You've got Russia, Iran, and China, who does produce some, but is a huge importer. So from China's point of view, she has secured as much energy as she needs. Now, the situation is spreading from there because you will be aware that the Houthis have increased their strike ability. I mean, I think it was last weekend on a border town, a town which is just in Saudi Arabia, they apparently routed three regiments of Saudi troops, you know, with all their wonderful equipment and all the rest of it. I mean, it seems that the Saudis actually couldn't organize light refreshment to a captive audience when it comes to military action. They've got all the kit, but they've got absolutely no ability whatsoever. The Houthis absolutely routed them. I mean, this is extraordinary. Not only that, but the story a few weeks ago was that it wasn't Iran which sent in the missiles to destroy or incapacitate the refining capacity of Saudi Arabia. It was the Houthis. Now, the Houthis do have the technology, but nobody wants to admit that this is the case. Now, think Iran, Houthis, Hezbollah. Now, suddenly, suddenly you have got this sort of new force gathering. And I think the way it is working is it's not trying to knock out Israel. I think they're moving towards knocking out Saudi Arabia. So there are very big developments going on in that part of the world which need very close watching. And we must be very careful not to take the line from Western governments who have an interest, if you like, in ensuring that the Saudis are not the problem and that Iran is the problem and the Houthis are just a sideshow.
Yeah.
That is not the case. That is not the case.
Very interesting. So Saudi Arabia, of course, Americans are wondering why we've been so close to Saudi Arabia after they drove airplanes into our buildings and attacked the country. And then, of course, you had this journalist that was recently done away with by the Saudis. So do you think, and I think in your article you mentioned something about Saudi Arabia being drawn more closely to China. She sees China as more of her future than the U.S. It seems to me that we could be looking at some real tectonic shifts here in the global geopolitical structure that could have some ramifications then, I guess, on currencies and the like, right?
Yes, I think that's true. I think I'm right in saying Saudi Arabia doesn't supply any oil to America whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
Her major customers are in Asia. And I think the objective of the end game that's being played, if you like, between China, Russia, and Iran are not quite so part of this particular aspect of the end game. But what they want to do, I think, is to capture, if I can use that in inverted commas, politically capture, if you like, Saudi Arabia from the Americans. And then they would very, very definitely have total control, if you like, of the majority of the world's oil supplies. Mm-hmm. And this is building Asia. It's Fortress Asia, if you like. That is the idea. And Asia on its own with Eastern Europe, we're going back to Mackinder's heartland theory. It is quite clear that this becomes a major force. We've got something like 3/4 of the world's population mm-hmm. involved. When you also include sub-Saharan Africa, which is supplying the commodities and raw materials for all this, 3/4 of the world's population. Suddenly, we can see that this is coming under China's control, mm-hmm. admittedly with her partners. And here is America trying to wage some sort of war against China, which is a mixture of tariffs, now beginning to try and choke off capital flows. She's already, I think, really on the fringes of this and being excluded. Mm-hmm. So, we then come down to which currency is the more stable in a mm-hmm. crisis? Mm-hmm. And that, I guess, might be your next question.
Yeah, I would think that's on everybody's mind. If the U.S. doesn't control the oil market anymore and it's controlled by 3/4 by China and Russia, and 3/4 of the world's population is now involved in that market, then the U.S. does get frozen out. What does that do to the dollar? Because it's my idea, my view. I think everybody that's thought about this understands that Kissinger went off to Saudi Arabia and arranged to have the dollar, all the oil from OPEC priced in dollars, which put a bid under the dollar when there was no longer any gold to justify owning the dollar. So this whole thing could come unraveled. I guess, how much time is it going to take, though?
I think the timing depends on when the next credit crisis occurs.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because when a credit crisis occurs, we sit and actually think, who's actually got the debts? Yeah. Now, we do know that there is a huge amount of debt in China, but it's not in the government. The government debt to GDP is around about 51-52%. Government debt to GDP in America is over 100%. So you can see that on that metric, the American dollar is not in the stronger position. The other thing is that the Chinese government controls virtually all the banking system. All the banks are basically state-owned. There are a few private banks on the fringes, but they're a very small part of the whole thing. So this means that Chinese banks are not going to go bust. because the government basically stands behind them already. In America, you could have a situation where if we get another credit crisis, the government ends up owning a few banks. But, you know, that's not the best way to start owning banks. And not only that, but if you start doing it and you've got to put out huge, huge amounts of capital and you're already in the hole to 105% of GDP as a government, you've got a big problem in a crisis. Mm-hmm. So I would, this is very unfashionable view, I have to say. And I was listening to Steve Bannon being interviewed by Kyle Bass the other day, and they've got this totally the other way around. I think they're wrong. The answer to this, quite simply, is that if they go all out financial war against China, it's the dollar that will collapse, not the yuan.
Yeah. Well, they don't see it that way. It's very hard for Americans to see that, Alistair. We have had dollar hegemony since, I don't know, I guess coming out of World War II, and then we went off the gold standard and then converted to a petrodollar standard. And so I guess it's really hard for Americans to see this, but you mentioned in your article that, you know, the Chinese are savers, the Americans are not, and a lot of the debt, as you just mentioned, is owed to these corporations, but the banks that have lent the money are government-sponsored and they're not going to go bust. But you make a point in your article that it's very important to note, and it's very important in terms of the financial structure and stability, that the Chinese do not have that level of consumer debt that we have. Could you talk a little bit about the debt? We just have about 4 minutes, 5 minutes left maybe. Talk a little bit about the importance of that debt, the difference in the structure between, even though they have 300% of GDP, the Chinese do, that it's not nearly as dangerous as it appears to most Americans. I guess most Americans think that China is going to go down and we'll be just fine and the dollar will be eternally the world's reserve currency, but obviously that's not something that history is going to.
Yeah. The quickest way to describe this is to think in terms of savers. If you have a very high proportion of saving in your economy, then the savers will place far greater trust in the currency than people in an economy where those savers don't exist. And that, I think, is the fundamental truth behind, if you like, in the gunfight at OK Corral, that is the fundamental truth for the backing of the yuan, which the dollar does not have.
You know, with just a couple of minutes left, the last time we talked to you, you talked about the dangers of the world's reserve currency having negative interest rates. Is that a trigger you think that might actually send the dollar reeling to the downside? That is, you mentioned that the dangers of the, and the differences of world's reserve currency, because all the commodities are priced in dollars. And, if the dollar goes negative, the time preference issue that you brought up will become very important, and people will likely dump the dollar and buy commodities and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the dollar interest rates needn't necessarily go negative. If they go to the zero bound and there is a belief that the next stage is for them to go negative, that will be enough to destroy the dollar, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I say it's hard for people. I mean, I'm 72 years old. I've lived in this country. I'm old enough to remember when we still had a quasi gold standard, Alistair. I don't suppose you're anywhere near that age, but I remember it very well. August 15th, 1971. I remember reading the New York Times, going into Manhattan from New Jersey, and reading about how this was a temporary thing. It wasn't going to last long, Nixon told us. But here we are, years, decades later, and a lot of people have gotten very rich by getting rid of an honest monetary system, but it's on shaky grounds now, I believe. And you know, the one bridge, one road. I mean, China's plowing ahead, aren't they? And they're no matter what happens. I mean, this Hong Kong thing, it seems to me, is likely to be a small incident in the bigger picture, where the Chinese are certainly using their earnings from net exports to buy up the world's goods, producing resources, mines and oil and that sort of thing, right?
Absolutely. And I think China's plan basically is to become more self-sufficient, if you like, in terms of, virtually everything. They're going to become more consumer-driven, which means that those savings will diminish. But the Chinese savings habit is very strong, like it is in Japan. And I mean, Japan has survived because it's of its savers, really. Mm-hmm. Against negative interest rates and everything else. So I think the yuan has got enough of those characteristics probably to see it through the changes that we're likely to have in the next two or three years.
Okay, with 1 minute left, what does this the gold hoarding by China, the massive amounts of gold, does that come into the picture here somewhere when the dollar goes bust?
I believe it does. I think it's it's effectively a backstop. Now, if the dollar goes bust, then the whole fiat currency system is going to be undermined, threatened, and possibly go down the drain with it. It is very important for Asia to have a gold backing, if you like, to provide an insulation against that Western phenomenon, the collapse of fiat currencies. And I think it is that that has driven the Chinese to accumulate over the years significant undeclared amounts of bullion. And I believe that that could be in excess of 20,000 tons. This is the state. I'm not talking about the people. They've got a further 17,000 tons, roughly, and this is an estimate. Gold and oil and rare earths are the commodities which China dominates and controls.
Okay, we'll have to leave a go at that. Thank you so much for being with us again, Alistair. Always a pleasure. That's it for this week, folks. Next week, Bob Moriarty is my guest. He's a 3-2-1 gold. Chris Taylor of Great Bear. And also, with a little luck, we'll have Michael Oliver back. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.